This is part two of a class series on the Lanka Avatara Sutra, the Buddha's appearance in Sri Lanka. One of the main sources, scriptural sources, of what we call the Yogacara tradition of Buddhism, the yogic practice school of Indian understanding, sometimes equated with what we call Chitta Matra school, which means mind only. One of the main sutras of the mind only way of understanding this world. And also one of the main sutras of teaching we call Tathagata Garbha, which means the heart of the Tathagata. The Tathagata is the Thus Come One, the Buddha. The Buddha heart teachings, or Buddha nature. Tathagata Garbha is another term for Buddha nature. So both mind-only teachings and Buddha nature teachings are both very important in the Zen tradition. Often in Zen, which is a separate transmission outside the sutras, they don't talk in this Indian way about mind only and Buddha nature and so on, but the Zen teachings and koan's teachings are often emerging from this background in Indian Buddhism. And this particular sutra, Lankavatara Sutra, it said that Bodhidharma, the Zen founder who brought Zen from India to China, on his journey across the ocean from the south, arriving in China from India, he just brought with him, besides a couple robes, he brought the Lankavatara Sutra. So that was like this precious transmission of Zen was contained in the Lankavatara Sutra. So the first few generations of Zen or Chan in China, those teachers, the first basically five ancestors of Chinese Zen, quote the Lankavatara Sutra quite regularly. And then after the sixth ancestor, it's not brought up so often. Sometimes, but it seems that Prajnaparamita Sutras took over as the precedence, the emphasis in Zen after the sixth ancestor. So the early birth of Zen is, according to legend anyway, and I think some scholarship, is largely based on this Lankavatara Sutra. And it's quite complex and difficult teachings. I always think it's nice to have classes on more difficult teachings because it's hard to understand on one's own. It's nice to be able to discuss. And this is like one of those sutras you can read on your own, but it gets a little gnarly sometimes. And we have, for those who weren't in the last class series, we're using red pines, relatively new, just like a half a year old translation from Guna Bhadra's translation into the Chinese. The other translation we have in English is D.T. Suzuki from 1930s. So we have those, and they're, you know, if you want to study the differences, these section numbers in Roman numerals are the same in Red Pine's and D.T. Suzuki's version, so you can easily compare. D.T. Suzuki's can easily be found on the web, and Red Pine's can be found in paper form. So, at the last class series, and you know, I don't know if we'll do another. Maybe this will be the last this time around. There's a lot in the sutra. We're only covering, you know, tiny bits and pieces. But I feel like we're kind of focusing on the central themes. So the last class series was on the eight consciousnesses, the eight consciousness system, which was an important Yogacara teaching that the later teachers like Asanga and Vasubandhu commented widely on eight consciousnesses, which just we won't get into that probably so much this series, but they are a consciousness associated with each of the five senses. There's an eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body consciousness. And then six is a mental consciousness, which includes mental direct perception as well as conceptual consciousness. And then there's a seventh. So early Buddhism has these six consciousnesses, and then this Yogacara system and Lankavatara Sutra posits a seventh consciousness that he translates here as will. And it's almost like a separate consciousness that carries the sense of an independent self. It's like the me consciousness is the seventh one that kind of taints all our conscious experience with this sense of self. It's kind of that sense of self is so important that it gets raised to the status of its own consciousness, called the seventh consciousness. And the eighth is Alaya Vijnana, the storehouse or repository consciousness, that some people might say is like, in Western terms, like the unconscious mind. Some might even say it's like the collective unconscious. There's some relationship between a collective unconscious and an individual unconscious. It's all our karmic tendencies. Every action that we've ever done, karma just means all our intentional activities. Everything we've ever done has like planted a seed in this storehouse, and that creates our unique personality, you could even say. Our uniqueness is the shape of our storehouse due to all our past actions. And our current karmic tendencies, our habit patterns, are said to arise from this vast and inconceivable storehouse consciousness. So that's the eight consciousnesses. Near the beginning of the sutra, in chapter one, in the last class, there was this section that that talked about all these bodhisattvas that are there with the Buddha in Sri Lanka, where he's teaching this sutra. And the bodhisattvas are skilled in the knowledge that external objects are perceptions of one's own mind, which is a central theme of the sutra, and they're also thoroughly versed in this little list here called the five dharmas, the three modes of reality, the eight forms of consciousness, which I just mentioned, and the two kinds of no self. So this kind of list of these four lists of numbered items appears throughout the sutra. The Buddha says these are the important things for bodhisattvas to understand. So that's was my intention in focusing on those lists, because they happen to be the lists that are also the kind of trademark teachings of this Yogacara school. So for understanding Yogacara mind-only tradition, as well as the sutra, that's a good kind of summary place. So the eight kinds of consciousness, and if you missed the last class series and you're interested in that, you can listen to the talks online, and I can give you a copy of the handout that has the main sutra sections on the eight consciousnesses that we talked about quite a bit. And this next series will be related, but in this series we can look at the five dharmas and the three modes of reality, or three natures. And the two kinds of no-self, there's some small sections in here, and we may have time at the end, or maybe not, but the two kinds of no-self are basically the no-self, the selflessness of a person, or of sentient beings, or people have no-self, according to Buddhism, but also all phenomena, all dharmas have no-self, no fixed identity. Those are the two kinds. And that's kind of this universal Mahayana Buddhist teaching. Whereas the eight consciousnesses, the five dharmas, and the three modes of reality are these particular, unique Yogacara teachings. So this class, this handout that I just gave out, is the first two pages are on the three modes of reality and the five dharmas, which are closely related. They're almost like two different ways of talking about the same thing. And then the last two pages are on Tathagata Garbha, or Buddha nature. So that's also an important part of this sutra. So I think between these four pages of summary and the last four pages of summary from the last class series, I personally feel like that's the heart of the sutra. But it's kind of like, it's my own biased version, reading through and really looking at. But in terms of these topics, this is almost everything that the sutra says about them, actually. This is maybe a little bit more, but these are like the main definitions and descriptions of these different teachings. And just to mention, before we get into the details now of the three modes of reality, we can talk about for several of these class days. You know, just a few words on maybe how to study sutras, or what's the point of all this? What are we doing? Especially as we get into this unusual kind of Indian language, and sometimes it even sounds like the Buddha's contradicting himself. And it seems to be a little different than other sutras that talk about these same topics. So it gets a little bit difficult, and I think it's a wonderful exercise to really methodically, carefully, and questioningly study these teachings for the sake of freedom and happiness and the welfare of all beings, which is every practice that we do, is for this reason. So sutra study, in this case, is one method, one mode of Zen practice to help us understand in a conceptual way, because this is words and language, it's getting a kind of conceptual understanding of how things work, how our mind works, and therefore how the world works, particularly in mind only. It's, those two are like basically the same. The way the world works is how our mind works. Yeah. Our mind is creating our world. So by understanding this in this version or other versions of conceptual teachings, we can see how we misunderstand things, how we grasp at ideas and thoughts and things and a world that isn't really the way we think it is. So the more we can understand that according to these teachings, things are not quite the way they seem, the more it loosens up our fixations on the world and ourselves and our thoughts and feelings and everything. It has that potential. And they're conceptual teachings, and we know that Zen, especially, all of Buddha Dharma, but especially Zen, is really about direct experience beyond all concepts and words. And yet this is the basis. It's kind of pointing us in this direction. In this very sutra is where, I don't know if it's the first place, but it might be the classic location of this teaching of the finger pointing at the moon. It's definitely in this sutra. The Buddha says these teachings are like, my finger pointing at the moon of truth. And people shouldn't get too caught up in the finger. and mistake the finger for the moon of truth. And the sutra itself again and again talks about the illusion of conceptual understanding and so on. But it goes on and on to create conceptual descriptions of how things are. So it's just to keep in mind as we understand this more and more that it's kind of a model. It's kind of a somewhat limited version of what really is. But I would say very, very helpful. So to jump right in here, this is in chapter 2, section 23 on page 99, if you have the book. This is some of the teachings on the three modes of reality. Tri Svabhava in Sanskrit. Often called, more popularly called, the three natures. The three natures of all things. Red Pine translates that as modes of reality. And, when I first heard that, I thought, I don't know, modes of reality, because one of these modes of reality is complete imagination. So already it's like, well, how can we call that a reality? But if we see that as like, well, that's complete imagination is one thing that we understand to be reality. Maybe we could distinguish truth and reality. It's like, it's a reality, but it's not true. So, you know, he's playing with this by calling it mode of reality. Svabhava in Sanskrit means like own being. Sva is like self or own, and bhava is like being or nature. So various translations of svabhava would be mode of reality. Self, nature, own being, I think that's good enough for now. And maybe for short, the three natures. In the Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra that will probably come up here too, because it's a kind of maybe a sister sutra to this Lankavatara. They're very closely related in terms of teaching. Also teaches these three natures, but there it's called the three characteristics of all phenomena. But same, that the same names and same descriptions, almost same descriptions. So in that sutra in particular, it's like three different ways to look at any phenomena. A phenomena is like a thought, an object, an experience. Every thought, object, experience, mental or physical experience has these three characteristics or has these three natures. I think that's a good way to start thinking about this. We're talking about three modes of reality. It's not kind of like abstract, modes of reality, but talking about each particular thing. This body right here has three modes of reality. Body's a good place to start because here it is. And we can like start looking at it in terms of these three characteristics or three modes, three natures of this body. But you could say this, the thought that's arising right now, now, the thought right now has three natures. Looking up at the sky and it's blue, that blue has three natures. So everything has three modes of reality, and they're called imagined, dependent, and perfected. So for those who were in a couple years ago, we had a Sandhi Nirmochana Sutra class, and we got into this, and they're described in that sutra, and this is nice because they're brought out a little differently here. And Vasubandhu and Asanga also teach these, and they're always slightly different versions, which can be maddening, but also I think can be really helpful and enlightening because it's like all these different angles on this quite subtle teaching. So this is the sutra. Moreover, Mahamati, who is the main bodhisattva, Mahamati is great intelligence bodhisattva, the main character that the Buddha is constantly talking with in this Lankavatara. Moreover, Mahamati, bodhisattvas should be well acquainted with the three modes of reality, the trees, Svabhava. What are the three modes of reality? Imagined reality, in Sanskrit, parikalpita svabhava, and some other translations here are imputational, imagined, imputational. Pari means like thoroughly, completely. Like pari nirvana is like complete nirvana. So, and kalpita means like imagined, imputed, conceptually constructed. So you could say complete imagination, thoroughly imputed, total fantasy. These would be different translations. Parikalpita. Dependent reality, paratantra svabhava. Literally, the other dependent nature, meaning the way that everything is dependent on things other than itself. And in the Sanjiva Mogena Sutra, the Buddha defines it very basically and straightforwardly. What is the other dependent nature? It's dependent co-arising. He just says it straight up, which is a term that many of us know. Dependent co-arising, interdependence, interdependent arising of all things. The appearance of all things, as we'll see here in the sutra. The way that things appear to arise dependent on conditions. So, dependent reality, or other dependent nature, and perfected reality, parinishpana svabhava. So it's the same pari. So nishpana means something like, maybe literally like established. So one translation would be the thoroughly established, or completely perfected or consummate in another translation. Perfected reality, I don't think that I would choose that term to translate. I think perfect is maybe a little bit better, because perfected sounds like it wasn't perfect and then it's now become perfected, but it's not like, this nature is not like that. It's the completely consummate, thoroughly established way that everything is, which is called suchness, or empty of any duality. But it didn't like become that way. It didn't become perfected from an imperfected state. It's just always and thoroughly and beginninglessly and endlessly perfect and complete and unchanging nature of all things. And as we'll see later in here, there's a connection between this perfect reality, the perfect nature of things, the way that they're free from all illusion, is equated or connected closely with Tathagata Garbha, or Buddha nature. Buddha nature is like the perfect, consummate, already complete nature of us. It's like the thoroughly established nature of a living being is their Buddha nature, or Tathagata Garbha. So we can come back to that, but all of these are woven together quite beautifully in the sutra. So now we have the names. The names, yes.
So you say that the imagined reality would be
Projected. Yeah. Yes. In fact, there's some.
Like the thing with the truck going by us, not that the truck's going by us, that's our projection.
Yeah, like we're constantly projecting a world, and particularly as we talked about the last class a lot, we're projecting an external world apart from mind. And there is this tricky thing going on in the sutra, and that people like Asanga also brings out. And as we read this, you can see what we make of this. It starts up. This is play between. So we have projected is a word that's come up a lot in the sutra, like kalpana. So it's the same root as parikalpita. This vikalpa is another word. It's kalpa is like imagined or projected, and pari makes it really thoroughly imagined. And you might have heard this term like nirvikalpa samadhi or nirvikalpa jnana means beyond, free from all projection and dualistic thought. But the tricky thing going on here is that we have this word projection, like there's projecting, and then there's the projections. So, and there's a kind of subtle relationship there because, as I understand this, it's like the projecting capacity of mind is part of the other dependent, part of the dependently arising projecting capacity, but the projections themselves, it's like, this platform, like, is a projection. It's like the object that has been projected. That's what's imagined. So my understanding is that the imaginary, nature is, we could say, the projected nature. And, whereas we have this word projection, that's a little bit different. So we'll come back to that point, but we have to be careful with our language. The projecting capacity of mind is different than the projections of mind. But then, yeah, I think we could translate imagined reality as projected reality. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thoroughly projected. Mahamati. So now he's going to start defining them in one way. Mahamati, imagined reality arises from appearances, or nimitta, which now, of these five dharmas that are going to appear later on, this is one of the five, is called appearances. Nimitta, usually nimitta is translated as signs, the signs of objects, but I think appearances is okay. The appearances of objects, or the signs of objects, are like at least slightly conceptual way by which we know an object. So like the signs or appearances of this piece of paper are the aspects of it that we can conceptually grasp. And that we can, I would also say that that when we name it paper, that name paper gets conjoined with the appearances or signs of the paper, and that's how we know it as this illusion called a piece of paper. So this is a little, just to refer back to a nice concise definition from the Sandhya Mochana Sutra, the other mind-only sutra, about these three natures, the Buddha says, how is it that this imaginary nature is known? And he answers, imaginary nature is known in dependence on names connected with signs or appearances. Names connected with these nimitta. That's how we know the imagined nature of the piece of paper, which is like Another way to talk about the imagined nature of the paper is that the imaginary nature is that it's a piece of paper and it's out here apart from mind. Like there really is a piece of paper out here that I'm not just projecting. It's really here and it's not my mind, or it's not just like, it's completely separate from, my mind might be knowing it, but it's here independent of this mind. That's like, it's called thorough imagination. And the irony is that for us, we live in the world of thorough imagination, right? We all probably agree, this is a piece of paper that's here apart from our mind.
It's paper-like.
It's paper-like? Well, how's that?
Well, I mean, all the signs put together, the thinness, the
weight. Oh, yeah, yeah, it has qualities of paper, yeah. So that's going to get woven in here, too. There's like, you know, the character, it has the characteristics of paper. And they're also projected. Yeah, the whiteness and the flatness and the black printing on it, all of that, those characteristics help us project very nicely a piece of paper out here apart from mind. But according to these sutras, that way that we usually see the paper is the thoroughly imagined or completely imputed. Imputed means like, you know, some reality is ascribed to something. Projected. We're projecting a piece of paper out here apart from mind. And the Sandita Mochana Sutra says, we know this piece of paper when the name paper gets conjoined to the appearances of the paper. Like they meet, and then we have, it's not just like now, it's not just an appearance, now it's a paper. And so naming and language is very connected to how we do this projection. Names connected with signs, so I thought that was interesting in that earlier sutra. Names connected with signs is how we know the imaginary nature of things. Now in this sutra, names and signs are two of the five dharmas, what's called the five dharmas in this sutra. And they're both brought up right here in this first paragraph. Now we have, imagined reality arises from these appearances or signs. How does it, imagined reality arise from appearances? Mahamati, as the objects and forms of dependent reality appear. So there's dependent appearances of an object. We could say it depends on, particularly from a mind-only perspective, it depends on like past, our past karmic tendencies for seeing paper. And it depends on the mind and the mind's perceptual abilities of to see. For example, if we close our eyes, it's kind of like we can't even really talk about this piece of paper anymore, right? So it depends on visual consciousness and eye organ and color and so on. Depends on all of these perceptual organs and so on. So as the objects and forms of dependent reality or the dependent nature appears, attachment results in two kinds of imagined reality. So it takes some attachment. Yeah. You could say there's a dependently arising appearance of an object here, but for it to become an imagined, truly existent piece of paper, or maybe we should say truly separate from the mind piece of paper, we need to attach to it as a kind of like a attached to the appearance of it. So as it says, as the objects and forms of dependent reality or nature, the other dependent nature appear, attachment results in two kinds of imagined reality. These are what the Tathagatas, the Arhats, the fully enlightened ones describe as attachment to appearance or signs, nimitta, and attachment to name, nama. So it's kind of funny in this sutra that it kind of breaks these down, because it seems like Another way to understand it would be when the name, actually, name paper attaches to the signs of the paper, then we have the imagined separate piece of paper. But here it kind of breaks it down and says there's these two kinds of imaginary imaginary reality, right? Two kinds of imagined reality. Attachment to the appearance of the paper and attachment to the names of the paper. So it kind of separates them. And you maybe we could imagine this as like, even without the name, we just open our eyes and boom, there's something out here. That's like we're grasping. Attachment and grasping is like the way that the, particularly in mind only, grasping is usually referring to grasping at an external reality, an imagined external. There isn't really anything external, but we grasp at things as being external through grasping the appearance or signs of a thing, and then attachment to the names. Like we could say, it really is a piece of paper. Don't tell me it's not. It is a piece of paper. So we're without any effort on our part, we immediately, upon opening our eyes, grasp the appearance of the paper as an external object, and we grasp the name paper as what it is. And now we might be able to reason with ourselves and say, well, we know that's just language. We know that's just a word. If I'm pushed on it and I really look, I see that I could see, oh, it's not really a piece of paper. But I think this is like the immediate grasping. You know, we open our eyes, boom. What is it? Oh, it's a piece of paper. It's like unquestioned. We recognize it very quickly as an object out here and as the, you know, what we call paper. So even though we can, you know, undo our attachment through reasoning a little bit pretty easily by saying it's not really inherently paper, still, don't we actually grasp it like immediately when we see it as a piece of paper? So I think this is what we're talking about here, is very naturally all sentient beings are doing this pretty much all the time. We're attaching to appearances and attaching to names. Attachment to appearance involves attachment to external and internal entities. And so I would understand this as, like we were saying, attaching to this is, it's external to mind, and then it's out here, it's external. We grasp it as an external entity. Internal, I'm not sure exactly what it means, but one way that we might look at it is, you know, this is an external thing, but the internal things we might grasp are like the sense organs themselves, like the eyes that are, you know, this is a color that the eyes are seeing, it's the external, but back here internally is the eye. But we grasp that too. We think that the eye really is an eye organ. So that might be one way to understand external and internal is like the sense objects and the sense organs. Because I think actually mind only doesn't mean that everything is in like our head or something, right? That would be like grasping an internal. I think it's important to know that mind only doesn't mean brain only, and it doesn't mean that everything is inside. It might be skillful to temporarily say things like the kingdom of God is within, because we're so externally directed. It helps us in Zazen and so on to kind of like, you know, come back within, you know, withdraw our external projections. But we're not really talking about within. That's just another location. Within is almost the same as out, without. It's like, whereas the mind we're talking about is not an internal mind. And even the sense organs are not internal, really. But I think we can grasp objects, external objects, and we can grasp internal objects. But actually, from a mind-only perspective, there's no external or internal. There's no location of anything. Mind has no location, and the projections of mind also have no location, but they appear to be located. So another, maybe another version would be like, an internal projection would be like our stomach, you know, that's not like a, or our intestines. That's not exactly like a sense organ, but we think that's internal. We think of it as internal, but we still, we're projecting. Our intestines are not the way we think they are. We think that there's, our intestines are separate from mind, which the sutra would say they're actually not. We're, the only way we know our intestines is as a mind projected intestine. Yes.
Could it be that internal entity could be the desire or aversion that instantly arises as soon as I see paper? I know either if it's green and it has numbers printed on it, you know.
Mm.
Oh, I want this. If it's a speeding ticket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that conceptual, internal might be conceptual objects, like that green and white paper is money, but we don't, you know, that's an internal conceptual deduction that's not just based on the colors out here. Yeah, I think we could look at it that way too, that, again, the sentence is, attachment to appearance involves attachment to external and internal entities. Yeah, so attachment to conceptual ideas that we that seem to be just mental factors. You could say physical and mental might be an external and internal. Yeah. So I don't know, again, what exactly Buddha's trying to say here, but maybe it's just emphasizing. If he just said attachment to external entities, that would be pretty good, but it's kind of like, but let's just make sure we're covering all entities. So let's say internal also. You know, in a way, what we call, anything that we could call internal, from a mind-only perspective, I think we could call it actually external. Like the intestines seem to be external to mind. External means like outside of or apart from mind. So, does that make sense? Like from a mind-only perspective, there's in a way no such thing as internal. The illusion of externality includes everything in any possible location. What, if we call it inside or outside, it all seems to be external to mind. So, attachment to appearance involves attachment to external internal entities, while attachment to name or names involves attachment to the individual and shared characteristics of these external and internal entities. So, you know, this is the kind of language of the sutra, right? If you're just kind of reading through, this is the part where you might start glazing over and like, I'm getting the general gist, but it's like all these words. So it's nice to slow down and really unpack some core pieces of the sutra here. Attachment to name involves attachment to the individual and shared characteristics of these external and internal entities. Now, maybe before next week, I'll look at the Sanskrit here. I think that it might be these terms, svalakshana and samanya lakshana, which is svalakshana might, we could translate as maybe individual characteristics. It means like the it means the way we know things, like in direct perception, like the you know, this particular color of the wood here in direct perception is like the svalakshana. It's the unique, specific, maybe that would be another way to put it, specific characteristic of this color. And it's like, it's what's perceived in direct perception. That may be what's being referred to as individual characteristics. And shared, or samanya lakshana, is like general characteristics, that's what's conceived in indirect conceptual understanding. So it's like another translation would be like generic images. So like if someone, you know, in direct perception we see the color directly, that's like an individual characteristic of this color. If outside the room we're having a conversation and someone asks, what color are those platforms in the Zendo? And you just kind of like imagine like, well, they're like varnished wood, so they're kind of brownish. You know, that's kind of like, you're not seeing it in direct perception, it's a kind of like, it's a general image that's a conceptual image. And that would be like, shared, we could understand as like, you know, well, all varnished Zendo platforms are kind of brownish color, so it must be. That's why we say like generic, or like, you know, you see like a moose's horns, and you actually see that directly, and somebody says, well, you know, what's a moose look like? And you just imagine, well, they have horns. And so it's kind of a generic image of all, you know, a general image of moose's horns, but it's kind of a blurry conceptual idea that mooses have horns. This is a little kind of Abhidharma type teaching about how perception works, that things have specific characteristics that are perceived in direct perception, and things have general characteristics that are just conceptually imagined, which starts to tie into, as you can see, this imagined character. But, as it says, attachment to name involves attachment to the individual and shared characteristics of these external and internal entities. So now we're not just talking about the objects themselves, like the piece of paper, the signs or appearances of the paper. We're talking about the names that are attachment to the way that the name paper is specifically grasping this piece of paper, and the way that we can just say paper and we can grasp the whole whole idea of paper in this world, the concept of paper, right? So names have a lot to do with concepts, but you can also, maybe it's a more subtle thing, but just naming a particular piece of paper is another kind of attachment. So again, the sentence is, attachment to name involves attachment to the individual and, or maybe we could say, or, shared characteristics of these external and internal entities, basically every kind of object. These are the two kinds of imagined reality, attachment to appearances and attachment to names. So that's the way this sutra talks. It's, you know, a lot more could be said there. We're kind of having to deduce, and we don't have any translated commentaries on the details of the sutra, so this is partly based on other descriptions and definitions of these three natures. We're just getting a sense here. We're starting to paint this picture, which we'll keep going through the next two pages. Basically, they're all, you know, fleshing out the story of these three natures and how it works. And the more we create the story, the more we can start to question how this is operating in our lives, how we are constructing our world, and how we grasp things as, you know, we believe that the thoroughly imagined nature of things is thoroughly real when it's thoroughly imagined. And maybe needless to say, but of course, the point is, when we grasp things that aren't real, internally or externally, that is the basic definition of suffering. in Buddha Dharma. Yes.
Why does it have to be suffering? Can it not be? Can you still do that without suffering?
Well, remember, you brought up suffering in the last class series, right? So, suffering is a big topic. That's a good question. Can you grasp external reality as being real without suffering? And I think we have to define suffering here. This was the issue last time too. And so thank you for bringing up, stopping the story here a little bit, just to look at what we sometimes call suffering. So dukkha is maybe most commonly translated as suffering, but I think more accurately something like discontent, not completely in nirvanic bliss. We could say anything other than total nirvanic bliss is dukkha. So that's being kind of strict, but that goes way beyond what we call suffering, it seems like. Well, we're not really, just to see that, like, this recorder is out here, it's not like, oh, that's so painful, you know? It's not that painful, but I would propose that seeing this thing out here is blocking nirvanic bliss. It's because it's like, it's slightly problematic. If anything is outside of us, which also means separate from us, right? It's not so bad. Like, you being over there doesn't bother me that much, but on this really deep level, if I get really settled, and this is like where Zazen can start to, you can experiment in Zazen, get really, really settled, just the fact that you seem to be like 20 feet away from me, it can be like excruciatingly painful. Just because this sense of separation, right? And you might say, well, right now we're just having like a peaceful little Dharma class here, and like you're all out there, I'm over here, and like we're doing cool. But actually, as soon as like if one of you out there would suddenly go like, like make a face at me or something, I might be like, I probably would be like, no. I'd be like, ooh, ah, mm. Like it's all going well until a face comes, right? And then it might be like, well, that's not really like suffering. That's just like the par for the course in this life. But I think the Buddha is proposing like there's something beyond par. There's like, yeah.
So that you can still never know anything about the Buddha and still have a good life, but you can, it's possibly more, and you could enrich your experience, I guess, by understanding this.
Yeah, you could say enrich experience, or you could say for the, what's being proposed as that, you know, the potential in Buddhism for complete freedom and ease in the most horrific situations is being offered. And we might say, well, I'm not in it for that because that's too far reaching, it's too much. But I always like to at least remember that this tradition does offer this possibility that there's, and you know, we could get into this discussion whether we might feel like I don't believe it's possible to be like when the evil beings are like ripping our body apart or whatever, that we're just like, this is bliss. But that's what is said in the sutras. The Buddha says, if you can't see this as total freedom at the most horrific thing, then that's not like Buddhahood. And you could say, well, there's all these gradations. And also, it's not just for us. You could say, in order to have, like, when we're all being torn to shreds together, a Buddha could, like, because they can see that this is imagination, they can help with infinite skillful means all these others who are greatly suffering. So it's not just for ourselves, but others too. And you could think, if it seems far-reaching, or it seems like, I don't believe that the complete freedom from suffering is possible, I would say sutras like this, for me anyway, are the point most directly to, if it were possible, this is the kind of way it would be possible, right? It's like the only way it would be possible to be totally free is to be completely, see reality in a completely different way. Like the way that we understand things is like, it's never going to work out. our imagined reality, we can improve it more and more, and we can like, you know, make more money, and we can have more and more comfortable life, but like, it's just kind of like improving samsara as much as we can. But, you know, we can have really, really high class samsara, but like, Buddhism offers something more. It's, you know, it's like it's a completely different shift of perspective where it's like, things are not what they appear. Because if they are how they appear, then eventually the appearances are going to turn on us, and we're going to have a problem. So we might not, you know, be able to cut through all appearances in this life, but I think I also like to, when we discuss these kind of things, I like to remember too that like, it's not, I don't feel like it's an all or nothing kind of deal. It's kind of like, well, if we don't completely stop believing that we're in a zendo and we're a person and all this stuff, then it's like the whole thing's useless. If that were so, I think Dharma wouldn't stay alive in this world. But I think it's like any little bit, just questioning our reality, even slightly, creates some freedom and ease. I think we probably all have some experience of that, or we wouldn't sit zazen. I don't know. It's like beliefs that we can see, like I'm really holding this belief and I really suffer, and then you know, something makes me question it in some new way, and I'm like, oh, maybe that's not quite the way I thought it was, or I see I'm really holding that belief and I just release it a little bit and there's a little ease. We all have those experiences, and I think that that's the same principle. So now we're talking about our most fundamental beliefs, that like, you know, the platform is not my mind. You know, really basic. Our beliefs that like structure our world, what we call reality. So we're kind of, this sutras like this question that. And it does come down to dukkha, and maybe we don't say suffering, but we say complete freedom from dis-ease or discontent, dissatisfaction, or to put it in a more positive way, if we don't want to get into all those disses, we could say we want to practice to realize this, to be like totally alive. I remember when I first got into practice, that's, I thought of it like, my life's not that bad, but I feel like I'm not totally alive. I'm not like thriving with like 100% of my being totally free, flowing life. And I want that. So you can see that's another way to maybe look at it, is like, I see like I'm hindered by my like constructs of, the fixed constructs of this world keep me from like the full expression of unhindered life, energy, expression. You're a surfer, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, so like, you want to just like surf, like totally, like no obstacles, like be totally one with the whole ocean and universe. And then at that moment you feel like, yeah, this is why I'm alive. And we want that, like, if we could live that way all the time, that would be so greatly beneficial to all other beings too. So that's a little aside about suffering. Nirvana. Nirvana is the Buddha did say, is bliss, but I think not like happy kind of bliss, but like the bliss of total, like, there's no more problem, because we see that we've constructed all the problems and we can't believe them anymore. And sometimes the Buddha says, instead of bliss, he just says, it's ease, it's complete peace and ease. There's no more struggle with the world, because we see how we're creating the world. So these are the two kinds of imagined reality that prevent this ease. What serves as the ground, ashraya, and I put that in there because we have this term, transformation of the basis is a term in Yogacara, paravritti ashraya. So we could say what serves as the ground or the basis and objective support, or alambana, from which they arise is dependent reality, the other dependent, also known as alaya vijnana. I think that's Red Pine's footnote, but I concur. When we talk about transformation of the basis, we're talking about the storehouse consciousness, the whole collective unconscious, is at its very being is inverted or overturned. It's revealed to be perfect non-dual wisdom. So that basis or ground that eventually gets transformed or undone, that is the objective support from which these imaginations arise, from which the imagined reality arises, is called the dependent reality or dependent nature. And we could say this the other dependent nature, dependent reality, is another name for it, is to tie it back into the eight consciousnesses, the storehouse consciousness. Because all things, all imaginations arise from that, don't they? Especially for those who remember that from the last class. All our, projections and the seventh consciousness, that's the belief in the self, all of it arises from these seeds in the storehouse. So that's the basis or the ground from which imaginations arise. And we could call that the other dependent character. It's the storehouse of dependent co-arising for us. It's our unique karmically influenced set of dependent co-arising. It's our unique dependent co-arising. That is dependently co-arising with everybody else's dependent co-arisings. Or all the alayas, we've had this conversation before. Everybody's storehouse is interdependent with everybody else's storehouse, and yet we have our unique karmic stuff in there. So so there's this connection between the storehouse consciousness and the dependent nature, and the dependent mode of reality. And the dependent mode of reality is the basis for the imagined mode of reality. And what is perfected reality? The third one now? Yes.
So when we did the Samjhya Mochana Sutta, we didn't. I don't think we equated a dependent co-arising, dependent reality with alaya vijnana.
We maybe didn't.
So in this way of looking at it, the causes and conditions that create dependent co-arising are the objects in our alaya vijnana.
Yeah, or maybe we'd say the causes and conditions, not so much that create dependent co-arising, but that actually are dependent. Right. Dependent co-arising is just the causes and conditions themselves, and that...
In the conventional way of thinking things, mm-hmm. this chair mm-hmm. arises because of mm-hmm. trees
and
wood shops
yeah.
and
That's like what I like to call the
stores.
Yeah.
And but in the mind-only school, the fact that this is an object outside of our minds mm-hmm. is because of the objects in our alaya-vision,
yeah.
eighth consciousness.
I like to call the way the chair rises depending on the woodcutter and the woodcutter's father and so on, is like, I like to call it the Thich Nhat Hanh version of dependent co-arising, because I think that's where we get, you don't find that really in the sutras or anything, that version of, but it's very accessible, that it depends on past events, for example, and it's true, it does, in the conventional sense, but yeah, from a mind only, and even from non-mind only teachings, usually when they're talking about dependent co-arising, it's more mind oriented, so you could say.
It depends on the I or.
Yes, like that. Yeah, yeah. Like, you know, this, the experience of this watch depends on many, many mental factors. Yeah, the direct perception of it depends on, yeah, the I organ, the color, and the I consciousness coming together, and then we also then bring in the sixth consciousness that mentally conceptualizes it as a watch, and the name connects with the appearance, and we have a watch, and all of that, according to the, you know, these eight consciousness, all of those events are arising from these seeds in alaya. So it's a kind of experiential model of dependent co-arising, is that the dependently arisen appearance of any experience or event or object depends on all of our perceptual and conceptual mind workings and all our karmic habit patterns. You know, like we have karmic setup for calling something that looks like this a watch, whereas some other people wouldn't have that. That karmic background, or even like this is very familiar. It looks like my watch, so I have this unique karmic thing. That, like, I don't just see it as any old watch. I think, oh, there's my watch. Immediately, it's like yeah. And from mind only perspective, everything that we're, this whole room, all of us are like arising from. For each of us, this room is slightly different, arising from our individual alaya vijnana, and that way that we project. This is again making that distinction between the projecting and the projections. So the projecting is part of dependent co-arising. It's part of alaya. It's a human tendency that we have. Amazing tendency we have to project. So when you're asking, does it have to be suffering? I would say. It does create this problem inevitably by projecting, but we also need to do it. It's like we're not a person, we can't be a person if we don't project. So we have this problem. So therefore, one could say, as long as we're a person, we're going to, we won't be completely content. But a Buddha, we have this Buddha nature that's like not, it's not a person nature, but it's right here with our person nature. So that will come in a little while. But perfected reality, what is it? This is the mode that's free from name or appearance or from projection. Samkalpa is projection. So all those things we just talked about, the names, the appearances, and the projection, which are... part of both the imagined and the dependent nature and the way that those work together. It's free from all of that. As I will say later, the perfected reality is free from not just the imagination, but it's also free from the dependent nature. It's attained by Buddha knowledge, and it's the realm where the personal realization of Buddha knowledge takes place. This is the perfected reality and the heart of the Tathagata Garbha. So there's where it first makes this connection between parinibbana, the consummate, thoroughly established, perfect nature, and the heart of Tathagata Garbha, or Buddha nature. The Buddha then repeated the meaning of this in verse, name and appearance and projection. These characterize two modes of reality, imagined and dependent. He doesn't break them down there. Later he does, but my understanding here is that name, appearance, and projection are all, if I had to put them in what I would say, put them all in the dependent category. But then, as he says up above, what makes the imagined? It's when you attach to the names and the appearances. But with just the names and appearances themselves, without attaching to them or believing in them as the reality, they're just part of dependent arising. Now later in this handout, the Buddha's going to say that the name and the appearance are the imagined, and the projection is the other dependent, I think he says. So maybe we'll come back to that. But at any rate, all three of them are definitely not the perfected. There's this interplay of the way that the other dependent nature gives rise to projections and grasping of external realities called the thoroughly imagined things, thoroughly imagined nature. Name and appearance and projection, these characterize two modes of reality, imagined and dependent. Correct knowledge, samyajnana, and suchness, tatata, these characterize the perfect mode. And so those happen to be what's called the five dharmas that we'll hear later. Those are the five dharmas. Name, appearance, projection, correct knowledge, and suchness. I just see on page 2 that will be explained, but that's what the five dharmas are. So seeing three of the five dharmas are in these imagined and dependent. Two of the five dharmas are in the perfect nature. Five dharmas is another version, in a way, of the three natures. Mahamati, this is what's known as the teaching of how to view what characterizes the five dharmas and the modes of reality. This is the realm where the personal realization of Buddha knowledge takes place, and which you and other bodhisattvas should cultivate. So that's a kind of heavy-duty introduction to the three natures, and the rest of this page and page 2 on the five dharmas, which is pretty much the same thing. We'll keep going on that for a little while, and you can read ahead. And you can look at Red Pine's footnotes in the sutra, and if you want to look at D.T. Suzuki's, you can compare the translations. And if you really want to get into this three natures thing, which personally I think is maybe, for me, like the highlight of these Yogacara teachings, is this three natures. I think it's more juicy than the eight consciousnesses. Even though the eight consciousnesses is a little bit easier to talk about and more popularly taught, three natures is the way these three work together, and very dynamic, and even within the Indian system, people talk about them in all these different ways that point out different like angles on the way we project the world. It's just a really great system, I feel like. And this sutra has one somewhat limited version, so if you're interested in that, I can point you to many commentaries on the three natures from different angles. But we'll keep talking about it too. I think, as you see, it's pretty hard. So, you know, the more you can, you know, we don't have homework assignments, but we could. Or you could just, if you want to really, for me, I feel like I had to spend a lot of time really working it from many different translations and the root text from the tradition to have it start to like flower in this way. Like, this is like the greatest way of talking about something. It might sound kind of clunky, but I think it's one of the greatest Buddhist models. It's a conceptual model, but I think it's a really, really wonderful one. This kind of three-pointed like pyramid thing. So enjoy. And enjoy your zazen, where you can actually, there's the potential to just like not engage the imagined nature and let the dependent nature just kind of like do its thing. But by not engaging it, it just kind of like, it's just mind churning around doing its thing. But if we're not like, if we don't solidify it into the imagined nature, then the perfect nature is like right there. That's like the freedom from the mind stuff that's just going on. So all of this is right there in zazen. It's like, and it's not just in zazen, but like behind our, you know, all day long and our complicated lives and busyness and fear and worry and anxiety and happiness and simplicity and complication. Behind all that, like this, the perfect nature, Tathagata Garbha, is just like shining forth, and it's, you know, empty suchness. And it's not like we have to like stop projecting, because we can't. But it's right behind the projections at the same time. There's this freedom. We dedicate any merit arising from this discussion on the three natures of reality to the peace, freedom, and nirvana bliss for all sentient beings. May they go through their days at ease. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become.